Real people. Real radio. Wherever you are, make it TFR. Truth Frequency Radio.
Always start, of course, where you got to start. The only thing you can change is yourself, and hopefully we can get people doing that and enough of them working together that, heck, we might could even affect a little bit of change. Roger Sales Radio Ranch, here we go on a Wednesday, miércoles in Spanish, October the 14th. I have as my special guest, second time on the program over here at least, one Deanna Spingola, notorious in certain circles, I'm sure. Deanna, welcome back to the Radio Ranch.
Well, thank you. Yes, I guess we both probably could be known as notorious.
In certain circles, you have to put
yes.
that disclaimer in there.
And that among leaves, certain tribes.
That's right. Or certain circles and period. That leaves a real nice nondescript thing
sure.
like they do. You know, that's how they trick you in with these nondescript things. Let me first get a little house cleaning out of the way, Deanna. I was want to tell the audience what you and I were talking about right before the show. My life has been a bit disrupted because yesterday about noon, I was eating a little cereal, getting ready. I try and get something in my stomach before the show and not eat a big meal because, you know, how after you eat, it makes you real slow down and lethargic. So I try not to do that. And I was eating this cereal and boom, the power goes off. And it just came on, sometime before I got up this morning. And so we were without power for about 18 hours. And it was throughout a large part of Buenos Aires. But like any large city, there's what you'd call, you know, the different cities abutted each to each other in the greater area. They have different names. But there were several of those out. And the funny thing is, Deanna, is that I had to take my computer and pack it up and go down a block or two and find a little cafe with a Wi-Fi, and they did have everything on. So it wasn't
wow.
just a whole area that was out. It's spotty. See, even in one block, a couple will be on and some of them will be off. So there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to it. But anyway, I was able to go over there and I have to have a couple of minutes before the show to put a rebroadcast in. And Tom, my usual Tuesday host, was sick as a dog and sounded like death warmed over. And I said, man, I'm not going to even attempt to try and do a show today. So I played a good one from a couple of weeks ago that was funny. Anyway, so that is what happened to me yesterday, but we seem to be back live and in living color, and so we'll see. Sound very good. Thank you, John. Using a new set of headphones today that I picked up, found a nice pair of Logitechs down here and picked them up yesterday. Inexpensive, but they seem to be doing the job, and so that's good. Thanks for the feedback, John. Deanna, it's been about a month or so since you were with us last, and we don't have anything planned to talk about, and that's intentional because it's my experience that spontaneous type shows or even things in life in general always seem to be the best because they flow naturally. And you're a wealth of information and dedicated your life for a number of years to finding out the truth and exactly who is doing what and why. And you've amassed an unbelievable amount of knowledge, and you've done a yeoman's job of writing your books and doing your programs and all that stuff. And you're to be commended, Deanna, because this is not a very easy stream to row your boat up, is it?
No, it isn't. You can lose a lot of friends and even family members who disagree with what your objectives are, or even what your beliefs are. Even if you have evidence to support your claims, so
they don't want to look at facts. That's the frustrating thing, and I've had that conversation just down here in the last few days. And you're trying to, people are calling you names and stuff, and you're trying to say, but look, this is all factual. Well, they don't want to look at any facts, okay?
Right.
They just want to dismiss you and demonize you and get this issue away because it's way too much for them to be able to handle, and they like their little pink cloud world. So it's a... it's quite an awakening. I don't remember if we covered last time when we talked. It's always interesting to me. What exactly woke you up?
Which time?
Well, I mean, I know.
The first time I woke up was probably when I read the book None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen.
What year was that?
What year was it? That was, must have been in the 70s. And of course the whole thing with the abortion issue in 1973, I just couldn't believe that some of my friends weren't outraged about the Supreme Court decision. And it was, I just could not understand, their lack of response.
Apathy.
Like, it's no big deal.
Apathy.
Apathy, exactly. And these were pro-life or supposedly pro-life people who should have been totally outraged at that decision. And I don't know what they thought about the women's movement, but certainly that was orchestrated and it was paid for and assisted by the CIA. And that was, of course, Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. And of course, it wasn't really the first time feminism, as they termed it, was an issue. I mean, this was something that was going on in the 1800s when people were attempting to displace the woman and to destroy the family unit, which is the basic unit of society. No matter what country you're living in, it's a basic unit. And once you destroy the family, you destroy the culture. So anyway, it was just, to me, I could see this happening. And I was just really upset, and then I started reading about it, and became, well, rather unpopular among my friends, and they thought I was, well, of course I've always been, kind of on the outskirts of things. I tended to be, think differently and see things differently, and I was kind of a loner, spent a lot of time reading.
It's funny, we have a lot of cookie cutter things there. You're not a joiner, are you?
No.
No, me either.
I'm not a joiner.
No. I love to sit back and look and observe and analyze. So that's, I guess we have a lot of similarities there. Maybe our personality types have some kind of convergence with the others out there in the audience that are attracted to this message and that think like we do, free thinkers, truth seekers, and wow, has it been a path for me, and I know for you also, Deanna.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any experiences with Jewish folks when you were younger? Of course, living, you did you grow up there in the Chicago area?
Oh, no. I grew up in California.
Okay.
And in Sacramento. And so I was not aware of their influence until, I mean, I knew they existed, of course. And I was, but I'm afraid that I was really taken in by their mythology regarding the Holocaust. And I just felt terrible. I thought, oh, those poor people. But then I got to thinking, and I guess I met a few when I was in my, my teens. And I thought, gosh, what a wimp this guy is. And I could see that his wife was really bossy, and I thought, well, maybe all the Jewish men are just wimpy, and maybe that's why they simply walked into the gas chambers and didn't put up a fuss or anything. And I thought, no, 6 million wimps or, you know, half of them if they were men or whatever. And I just couldn't believe that people would be so docile as to allow themselves to be exterminated. And it just didn't make sense to me. Although I still bought into the story, I just figured these people are really defective if they're going to allow this kind of thing. And then, in the late 1980s, I got a divorce, and I had always sewn most of my clothes. I was very familiar with textiles and patterns and that kind of thing. And here I am after being a housewife for a number of years. I had to go out and actually find a job. And I got a job actually before the divorce and before things kind of erupted in my family. And I got this job as a representative for a lace company that was located in Florida, and it was owned by a Jewish man, as all the textile companies are. Most of them are dominated by Jews, and it has something to do with their religious mythology. In other words, you have to, when you're eating a meal, the meat has to be some on one part of the plate. You can't mix these things together. And so it's quite understandable that they would want to dominate the clothing industry so that they could make this, so they could apply the same religious myths to clothing where you wouldn't mix cotton and some other fabric. And so, and also, I mean, it was a good way for them to make money. They were the middlemen. They could import stuff and triple charge people for it. And anyway, so I had this one line, and then I picked up five or six other lines. And I was an independent rep. I worked on commission, and I learned real quick that Jews will try and cheat you out of your commission, and they're also womanizers. I mean, I would go to a trade show, and my gosh, I couldn't believe these people. I mean, they were just the majority of them just seemed to have no morals at all.
It's very interesting. You touched on a couple of things that I wanted to explore. I had the article. I was going to cover it yesterday with Tom, and we didn't get to do a show. You've taken the Holocaust, and they've had to go so far as to make it criminal and criminalize it. Of course, we know with all the people that have done their time, Ernst Zundel and on down the litany. You know what they're trying to criminalize now? They're so desperate, they're trying to criminalize climate change. They had a big meeting in the United Kingdom with all of these judges from all over the world under the auspices of the UN, and they're trying to take up a climate denier as a crime, like a Holocaust denier.
That is pathetic.
Now, it gives you a real interesting insight into their methodologies.
Sure.
And it gives you another interesting insight, what I've been telling this audience for a long time, because I didn't think that anybody, I've never heard anybody really correctly, to me, in my way of thinking, us being independent thinkers, approach this climate change issue. But I understand it perfectly, and I understand why they're having to go to these links, because it is the absolute key to the world, one world currency. and they've got to get it passed before they can get the one world currency in place. And their whole financial scam is imploding underneath them. Something came to me very interesting yesterday. As a matter of fact, I had a lot of time to think sitting around with no electricity.
Oh, yes. You start reading more books and doing all kinds of things.
Lighting candles and garden. It's very dark, you know, all that stuff. But the phrase biblically that was used against these people 2,000 years ago was a very interesting term, the leaven of the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, leaven is yeast, and that's right. What unleavened bread is, the flat bread, like a pita bread or something.
Right.
And the yeast, of course, makes the bread rise. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take that leaven of the Pharisees and look at it today, look at the leaven that they've used in the financial system. Look at the leaven they've used in all these social systems. They ratchet it up, ratchet up, ratchet up, ratchet up, just like yeast would make bread rise. Now, isn't that an interesting analogy? I'd never looked at it like that until yesterday, okay?
Hmm.
And it just came to me out of left, you know, the old subconscious is delivering you that, and here comes this phrase, the leaven of the Pharisees, and I started thinking it through, and I went, wow, isn't that a perfect description?
Yes. Yes. Yesterday I started reading Rosenberg's book called The Track of the Jew. And I got it on Kindle. And he mentioned enlightenment and the Illuminati kind of thing and Freemasonry. And he talks about a lot of those issues. And talked about how the Jew just inherently gets into the pockets or fills the pockets of the politicians, and that is how they actually use their influence across the board against all people, is because first they buy the judges and the politicians, and pretty soon they have all this power. And anyway, it gives a very nice history about it. And I've read a lot of histories pertaining to this. And
I sent you an ebook a while back that I remember you thanked me profusely for. I read part of it. I wonder if you had a chance to delve into it, called The King's Jews.
Ah, no, I haven't. I'm sorry.
It's very interesting.
I probably scanned it at the time.
There's some interesting things that come out of the history here. When they were allowed back into England, the king basically let them back in, but he owned them as property. They literally were the property of the king because they were loaning him money, and therefore he let them out there in the countryside amongst his subjects to procure usury upon them. Okay?
What an awful thing, yes.
And so that's what happened there for a long time, is the Jews were actually the property. It's really interesting to me to look back at the historical part of this. And I mean, listen, Deanna, there's nothing new under the sun.
Right. But property or not, they still were in the exploitative situation where they benefited. And so I guess they'll accept any name, as long as they can make a benefit, you know, make a profit.
It's a super interesting ethnic race, to my knowledge, of any major ethnicities. It's the only major ethnicity that's maternal based.
Which is very interesting, too. Yes.
And, you know, the right of return, to be able to have mm-hmm. exercise your right of return. Your mother had to be Jewish.
Right.
A lot of some of the business people, Murdoch and some of those people, their father was Gentile, but their mother was Jewish.
Right.
And I've always wondered, because then in their... And you don't know which sect we're generally talking about. There's a number of sects here, and you can't really overgeneralize too much. You have to understand that they have their own splinters like the Arabs do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And but some of these sects really denigrate women then, on top of that, after it being a maternal ethnic religion and ethnic group. And it's always been very perplexing to me.
Right. And it's kind of interesting because the Old Testament is kind of patriarchal. You don't hear, well, there's hardly any mention of any women at all except Ruth and Esther. And yet you have this, this powerful, woman, as I witnessed when I was in my teens, that these women all seem to be very, well, domineering and have a lot of influence.
Well, if any of them are real biblically fluent, you can go up and say one word that'll drain them wise as a sheet, Deanna.
And what's that word?
Obadiah. Have you ever read Obadiah?
I probably have, but I don't recall what it is.
Well, it's the shortest book. It's the shortest book in the Bible, in the Old Testament. It's about a page and a half. I would encourage you and all of the listeners, if you haven't read it, to go look and spend just a few minutes reading Obadiah. And if you mention that word to any of those people, many of them will drain white as a sheet because Obadiah is just about upon them.
Huh. Well, it's interesting, though, you know, a lot of the Jews that I met in the textile industry were just very not religious. They probably celebrated the certain holidays just because it was traditional. But I don't know that any of them ever actually attended a synagogue, or I think their God is their money.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading an article on Chucky. I call him Chucky the Schmucky Schumer. On Chucky the Schmucky Schumer a while back, and they were talking about he did some kind of a rare public town hall meeting on something he was trying to stump up. And in the article, they just went on to say that, well, it's pretty rare for Schumer to do town hall meetings because all he does is politics from synagogue to synagogue. And that they, and I don't remember if it was that article or another one, but they were talking about as high as 49% or more of the people in synagogues are totally atheistic, exactly like you're saying, okay?
Oh, but the synagogue is a meeting place.
And it's a political place, too. And, gosh, I wonder, shouldn't that fall under 501c3 public policy regulations?
Yes. You know, I was in a synagogue once because after I became involved in the textile business, I decided that I was going to start quilting because when I was on the road, I took my sewing machine with me. Because I certainly wasn't going to go out. A lot of the reps would go out drinking and whatnot, and I don't drink. And so I wanted something to do. I'm not a TV watcher. And so anyway, I designed some quilts, and I actually wrote a couple of quilt books. But then I after I designed some quilts and wrote my books, then I began traveling as a quilt instructor, teaching the methods in my books. And I went to a group of quilters invited me up in the northern suburbs here in Chicago to come and do a presentation. And the presentation was in a synagogue that was mostly Jewish women. And anyway, when I arrive at these places, I would sit with the audience, and I would get there a half hour to 45 minutes or so and hang up a bunch of quilts and get everything arranged in my slideshow and whatnot. And then I would go and sit down. And I was a bunch of women joined me in the row of chairs. And I tried to say hi, you know, and boy, these people wouldn't even talk to me. I mean, literally, they would not say hello, nothing, nada. And so then I got up and did my presentation, and they, you know, clapped and had questions and all this stuff. I went back and I sat down, and this lady next to me, and I quote, she said, "If we had known who you were, we would have talked to you." And I thought, holy cow, what a snooty bunch of women. I mean, could, to me, I thought that was outrageous. What was so outrageous is that she actually admitted her bias, her whatever it was they were feeling.
It's that's a very interesting and insightful story, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. They're very exclusive people, and you know, why should they talk to some blonde, blue-eyed goy?
One of my listeners is married. We'll see. We're getting pretty close on time here. I can probably get this in. One of the advocates of our program is married to a real big Hollywood guy, and I've met them, and great folks. And he's Jewish, and he's from Chicago. His dad was a big doctor up there. And when he was 6 years old, they sent him to the kibbutz, you know, the whatever, the yeshiva school.
Sure.
There. And at 6 years old now, and they're mm-hmm. telling him, you're better than everybody else. You're better than everybody else. And he was going, what the hell is this? And he literally has had a atheistic life because of that. And he really bolted it from that whole scene because of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I thought that was interesting that they're, you know, at that youthful an age sitting there hammering, that, well, racist message, if you will. I don't know any other way to put it.
Sure. But I think that that is typical. I think that's traditional and that's the way that they are brought up. And when you see, and we've all seen the pictures of the young Jews in the Israeli state, and the way that they behave, the way that they act. I mean, it's outrageous. I mean, they're so...
Well, we got an outrageous break, Deanna, so hold that thought. And, Roger, Deanna, more open-ranging discussion. Radio Ranch, back in a minute.
Radio Ranch with Robert Sales. Monday through Friday on Truth Frequency Radio.
And the river opens for the righteous. 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 And the river opens for the righteous someday.
Walking with my brother down the Freedom Road, hopefully. Roger Sales Radio Ranch. My guest today, Deanna Spingola. We're just kind of having a general discussion, as we're apt to do over here at the Radio Ranch. It's a Wednesday, the 14th, in the middle of what promises to still be a tumultuous month, Deanna, and certainly a very bumpy to the end of the year, it appears.
Indeed. In many respects, I think.
We drew a couple of parallels last segment about techniques of these guys. And that's one thing that I've tried to do for many years as I read about them. And I've, you know, the best way to find out about these guys, and it's not a big mystery. You mentioned some book by Rothstein or, I mean, there's a ton of books.
Rosenberg.
There's a ton of books out there, written by Jews themselves that tell these stories.
Right. Well, actually, he was not Jewish, but he had experienced the Russian Revolution and knew how the Jews operated and saw them come into his country and take over the whole country and destroy millions of people. And, so.
They've got.
That sounds like a Jewish name, but it isn't.
Okay, they've got a definite technique. I crossed paths about 15 years ago with some old Germans. They were up in Milwaukee. I guess there's a
lot of old Germans up in Milwaukee.
Big contingency there, evidently, and they were too. And it was back when I repped Silverlon. I don't know if you've heard of that product or not, but back 15 years ago, around Y2K, I was repping that product and knew the inventor through a mutual friend, and it ended up being a very good thing for me. But she was one of my customers, and she bought this Silverlon wrap we were selling at the time. The company, by the way, was stolen by our Edomite friends.
they stole
everything, the patents, the backdated contracts, right there in your backyard, actually.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, their name was Adler, and that, too, is a Jewish name in many aspects, but they, like your author there, were not Jewish. And, boy, did she have some things to say about them from Germany.
And, oh, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, man. And, she called them cuckoo birds. Cuckoos. Hmm. And the reason for it is over there, there's a bird called a cuckoo that, what does it do? It goes in and it lays its egg in another bird's nest.
Parasitical kind of a.
Yeah. And then when the eggs, the other bird hatches the cuckoo and it comes up different and it kicks all the other birds out and takes over the nest.
Well, how appropriate to call them that then, right?
Well, I thought so. She obviously did. Sweet people. They both passed away, of course, a number of years ago, but very interesting experiences that I've come along the way. I started, when I was in college, I was working just, you know, how you get out and work in college, like you were talking about. And I ended up working in clothing stores, shoe stores and clothing stores and stuff in retail. And I mean, it's just like you with your cloth business. It's ubiquitous. It's very unusual that you'd find a Gentile store owner in those areas, you know?
Yes, yes. Just amazing. I just, it was quite an eye-opening experience for me.
Well, then I go on and end up in the record business. Once again, Chicago companies. I think we touched on it last time. I started out in the business. My first job was with Mercury. And Mercury is an old Chicago company. It, our offices were in the IBM building right there on the river, downtown next to those two round condominiums. And so I'd never been to Chicago. I had to come up there a number of times and stuff. But the record business is rife. I mean, rife with Jewish folks. Now, I had some dear Jewish friends, okay, and people that were very dear to me that I know were special people because I knew them very well, you know. So you can't broad brush this, but there are certain – of the variety, let's say, that are more predisposed because of whatever, going to schools where they tell them they're better than everybody else or what other kind of crap is going on to mold these people into what they become. But I saw a book, Deanna, it was written about 100 years ago by, I guess, a guy that's a famous Catholic writer. His name is Hilaire Belloc.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And his whole book was on the Jews. And said in that book, the biggest problem in the world is the Jewish problem. Now, that was his statement, not mine.
Sure.
It was 100 years ago. And I dare say that we've still got the same situation.
Sure. And people used to be able to express, well, even Martin Luther, certainly. I don't know what year he wrote his book, but he was certainly forthcoming in his opinions about them. But somehow, well, probably because they own the media, we don't hear that much about how awful they are. People are not writing books about their behavior, except, well, a few people. But certainly it isn't, those books are not on the New York Times bestseller list.
You will not see them there.
No. No. And of course, that whole list is a farce to begin with. Because it is basically it's a list of of books that a certain entity is attempting to promote. It's not based on the number of books that are sold, but it is based on what the New York Times, which has always been run by the Jews, would like people to read. So it has nothing to do with sales, the quantity of sales or anything.
We were talking a minute ago about, you mentioned something about traditions.
Mm-hmm.
I had an incredible story. I could probably dig back on my other browser and find the exact stories. And we may have touched on it the last time you were here, but I think it's really illustrative in the vein that we're talking about today of there's nothing new under the sun, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And that came, to us from Australia. And what happened in one of their kibbutzes down there, there was a kid that was accused of pedophilia inside the kibbutz. And It got – somebody inside it reported it to the police. And in the ongoing legal struggle, they hired a very well-known local attorney named Lowenstein, obviously one of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And his, they came out with some excerpts of some phone tapped conversations. And in the conversations, he was chiding the guy and said, "We have traditions. You do not take these things to the outside." And what struck me about that was the phrase, "the traditions of the elders." Now,
right.
The traditions of the elders is what Jesus railed on them and called them, which
right.
500 years after his crucifixion became not of the elders where it was passed down orally from father to son, but written, and that's the Babylonian Talmud.
Right.
And here it is today with a pedophile case now. Now, they expect everybody else to not be induced or participate in any of the trash that they put out there to socially engineer these societies all over the world, mainly through movies and music, okay?
Right.
But they don't have to adhere to it. They're able to supposed to stay within their group because they have traditions.
Right. And that is in their Talmud, that they are allowed to take certain sexual liberties with whomever they want.
Yeah, I think the famous one about the, a girl's virginity is until she's three is like poking your finger in an eye, it tears up and comes back. I think it's something to that exact language.
Exactly,
there.
Yes. And it's not even little girls. It's any, female or male. I mean, I think we've all heard the stories about the things that go on at the bathhouses where these old Jewish rabbis are abusing little boys and little Jewish boys. So
I don't want to hear anything that goes on at the bathhouses. Yeah, thank you.
I'm sorry I brought that up, but somebody brought it up to me a couple of weeks ago, and I'd heard the story when it first came around. I thought, I don't want to know.
Well,
about
you
this.
You have to put that disclaimer out there, Deanna. No, I really don't want to know any graphic detail about all of that. Nor about, if you want to just get down to published news stories, or about the rabbis performing circumcisions with their teeth, and
yes,
or any of these really, really good for the family meal conversation
sure.
type thing.
Well, you won't read about the circumcisions and hepatitis B in the New York Times, that's for certain. But if a Catholic priest does something, boy, you're going to hear about that 20, 30 years after the fact. And when you think about it, you think, well, let's see. Did we hear about these things? Did they hear about these things prior to 1965? Wasn't that when the Second Vatican II was implemented?
You got me. But I do know this.
I'm not Catholic, so I have no
idea. I'm not either, and I don't either, but I don't have to be Catholic to know this. Some pigs are more equal than others.
Sure. But I think that there was a big infiltration. And when you look at today's Pope, he's nothing but a Marxist. I mean, he's the first Pope that has ever addressed the U.S. Congress. I saw a cartoon that said that that the Pope was visiting the sick and afflicted when he visited Congress. Which I thought was kind of funny. Mentally deficient.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. So at least he was doing a religious kind of a thing.
Well, you saw the gift. It was the picture. It went all over the world. The Morales gave him the Christ crucified on the hammer and sickle just up the road from us in Bolivia.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you not see that?
No.
Oh, no. Yeah. It was when he was on his South American tour about a month ahead of when he came up there to the
U.S. Right. Uh-huh.
And he was in Ecuador and Bolivia and Paraguay, I think. Mm-hmm. And in Morales up there, who's an indigenous president from that. And I've got a friend that lives up there that I met down here. And he said the other a bunch of – it's a different way of looking at communism, I guess. But regardless, when the Pope made his little stop in La Paz or wherever it was, Morales presented him with a cross side of a – cross view of a hammer and
wow.
Christ was crucified on it, on the cross.
Wow.
I mean, is, you know, and they had to distance, the Vatican had to distance itself from that because he was like, here, the president of the country's giving you this. There's the photographers. Mm-hmm. You can't have a frown on your face.
Sure.
And so they had to come back and backpedal. He was no way endorsing stuff like that. And of course, he's Argentinian too. But there's a lot of information out that he had leanings here in the 80s when they had their military junta, leanings and dealings with the military junta, and not the communists. They were out after the communists. So I don't know if the guy doesn't just blow in the breeze or whatever, but being the first Jesuit priest, pope ever, and seeing what we've seen, going to the UN, calling for the structure of the world government.
Yes, and talking about, he also was talking about climate change.
I was going to say climate change because they've got to get that structure in, and they've got to get that tax in place or they can't pull off the world currency. And it really has got their butts into a corner. And you're seeing the desperate moves and the links they're having to go to get that addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other part that's interesting, Deanna, to me, because I follow the financial stuff a lot, is with all of the 0% interest rate, what they've really done is gone back and allowed corporations to borrow cheap money, which they normally would go and build infrastructure and, you know, new plants and new products and hire workers and all that stuff. But instead, they're taking the cheap money and they're buying their own corporate stock back, and they're doing a lot of mergers and acquisitions and building them up and solidifying the, if you will, again, the leaven of the Pharisees. Now they've got the Pope calling for the master big structure, and they're building up the corporate control structure with these trade treaties and all this finance garbage up underneath. And, so we're at, you know, you can, if you understand what these guys are doing, you can sit back and see how they're constructing it.
Sure. And speaking of infrastructure, we've had a lot of flooding in South Carolina, and most of the flooding, I mean, certainly it's been because of the rain, but a lot of the flooding is because a lot of the dams are failing in that state.
I thought it was because they had a sissy senator.
No, I think it's infrastructure.
are you sure? I thought the rain was because they had that sissy senator over there.
No.
You know what my wife used to say, would have said about him, my deceased wife, Frankie, would say, he had a little sugar in his britches.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I don't know. South Carolina's been very pivotal lately. They're banning the Confederate flag. They got that little, false flag dealy going on in Charleston. Don't forget that's where the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry was founded. It's on the 33rd degree parallel. Big slave port, start of the Civil War. You know, a lot of doings there around Charleston.
Yeah. Very interesting.
A lot of things coming to a head, and it's really interesting. What else? Let's get back to our guys, to our buddies, our pals.
During the break, I looked up Obadiah. It's only like 21 verses here.
It's very shortest book in the Bible.
Yes. It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you get just a few minutes to pause after the show or whatever. You may want to cast I believe you'll like what you're reading there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, anyway, a lot of people never heard of that. I hadn't until some point a number of years ago, and I heard Pete Peters talking about it. Yeah, it's just this little page and a half, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. What else did I want to cover with you? You got anything interesting to add on a current that you've been researching on our pals? Maybe we can open up the phone lines here in the next segment.
Well,
I think there's a lot of my listeners that would like to speak with you, and we'll take it up to the break and do that in the next segment. But
okay.
What has interested you lately, Deanna?
Well, on Monday, of course, it was the day that the government – mandated that we celebrate Christopher Columbus. And so I did a program on my Blog Talk program about Christopher Columbus and the fact that he was Jewish, and gave a bunch of information about that to kind of confirm it. And as evidence, I used a couple of different books, one of which was called Sails of Hope by Wiesenthal. Simon Wiesenthal, and it's a very good book. And then there's also another book that I used by Amler that talked about his Jewish roots. And so anyway, I thought that that was kind of interesting, in as much as he was responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of people, the natives in the Caribbean. So yeah, it was a very disturbing program, because when you're talking about killing millions of people, and then I gave some examples of how, they did this, how they killed these people, and it was such brutality and such, it was just,
it's, you know, there's a very interesting legal word called heinous.
Yes, yes.
And a heinous crime is something that's over and above.
Yes.
And you look at what they did here, and this wasn't Christopher Columbus, but it was certainly a lot of the Jesuits that came with him and certainly followed after, the way that they wiped out a lot of the tribes all over the northern and southern part of this hemisphere was with typhoid-laden blankets. They'd give them blankets laced with smallpox.
Right.
And wrap their babies in smallpox, and boom, they're done, you know.
Right.
And now that is heinous, you know, malice aforethought.
Sure.
And
that was Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who was early, let's see, it was about in the 1700s, 1783. He created an epidemic among the Cherokees, which helped Washington's forces and ended the Cherokee's resistance. And what they did, as you said, is that Amherst directed his men to distribute smallpox-laden blankets among the Indian population in order to decimate them without firing a bullet. And, I mean, it's just cruelty above and beyond. And when you and Columbus, when he sailed, the government, Spain, had decided that they were going to get rid of all of their Jews, particularly the Muranos, because those are the ones that pretend to be Christian, and they never really abandon their Jewish faith. They practice in secret and whatnot, and they wanted to get rid of them.
That was a result, for the listeners, just fill in background if you don't know, that was a result of the Spanish Inquisition.
But you know who was doing a lot of the Inquisition? Was the converted Jews were behind a lot of the the Inquisition.
Wouldn't surprise me in the least.
And behind a lot of the, well, the slaughter.
And the story that I read years ago was that Isabel or Ferdinand, one of them, had connections in that way, and that they were the one that sponsored Columbus so that he could look for a place in, for them to go.
Yes, yes. And Isabella, I mean, she was very interesting. And in the papers, it referred to Queen Isabella and her husband, Ferdinand. I mean, it seemed like she was kind of the main person in that couple. And so it's very interesting. I covered it in my first book. The name of my first book in the trilogy is The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. And I talk about the emancipation of the Jews in Germany, but I do cover Columbus. And anyway, they were supposed to leave in August, by August the 2nd. By August the 2nd, they were supposed to be, that was the day they were supposed to all leave. And they talked about the expulsion of the Jews, I believe in March of 1492, and they gave them until August. And so typically, sailors and the people that were going aboard ship would wait till the very last minute to spend time with their family and whatnot. But Columbus directed all of his crew to board the ship by 11 o'clock, an hour before midnight, on August 2nd. They didn't leave until the very next day, early in the morning. But he wanted to make sure his entire crew was on board before midnight. And, of course, this was the last day that the Jews could stay in Spain. And so, anyway, so he and his group, many of whom were probably Jewish, left. And when they arrived, there were about 11 million Taino Arawaks. Taino means peace. And these people were so peaceful. They did not, they were without guile. I mean, they were just totally peaceful. They were so naive that they would even grab the sword's blade, not even realizing, you know, that this was a dangerous thing. They didn't kill each other. They lived harmoniously. And then they thought that he was a man from heaven when he first arrived. Well, first of all, they all ran up in the hills because they didn't, you know, they were frightened. But then they were curious, so they came down and, but, yeah, within 4 years, there were 3 million. From 11 million.
Wow. The reports that I read years ago by a guy that did an independent history periodical a couple of times a month, the Dynamite stuff, and on the issue and talking about this, I remember it was the first time I'd been exposed to it. And the other thing that sticks in my mind is that many of those that stayed eventually changed their names to flowers. And that's where you get Rose and all of those things that came out of that. So, interesting history. Interesting
Rivero?
History.
Well,
I don't know. So he got them all on the boat by midnight on the last day that they could legally mm-hmm. stay in Spain. There was a whole contingent of them that also went up to Amsterdam. And that's why you've still got
yes.
all of that. And now we've got a contingent on break. Deanna and I and some phone callers be back.
Your mama says keep away.
We are TFR.
My hated destiny is all I need to prevail.
Truth Frequency Radio.
Population keeps on bleeding. Nation bleeding. Still more bleeding. Economy. is funny, skies are sunny, bees make honey.
We're in this third segment, Radio Ranch. It's a live show. I have Deanna Spingola with me, and happy to have you again on the show. Deanna, I enjoyed these conversations, and I think you'll agree with what I'm going to say. When you get in and start studying any of these issues and get into the depth of them, it's very difficult to find people that you can sit down and talk on a level playing field with.
For sure. Oh, my goodness. Yes. And you were talking about Amsterdam and the Sephardic Jews, and those are the people fleeing from Spain, first went to Portugal, then they went to Amsterdam following the closure of Antwerp's harbor in 1585, and then Amsterdam became the commercial and financial center of Europe, and then they got involved with the company, the East India Company, which was a corporation that was owned by the goldsmiths. So, when you look at their travels, and what they refer to as the diaspora, they really, you know, they like to say, oh, we were kicked out of this place and we were kicked out of that place and we've been forced to disseminate all over the world. It was by their choice that they wanted to spread out. They were spread out on purpose before anybody decided to expel, get rid of them out of their country.
Well, let's not forget about the notorious legend of Jewish mother guilt and how they use it in their political maneuvers and social change.
Oh, sure. Poor little me. Oh, please. Poor little me. Look what's been done to me. Oh, my goodness.
It's no coincidence out of that little nest that formed there and became very active in Amsterdam that many people have the mistaken idea that the Bank of England was the first central bank, because I've seen that in print before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true. The first central bank, the concept of it, came out of Amsterdam. And
right.
It's no coincidence that the central bank concept and the concept of insurance came out of the same city in the same year, all right? And it was that money, evidently, that financed William of Orange to go back over and take back over England. And
mm-hmm.
then they allowed them back in, and then Rothschild pulled his maneuvers and took control of the Bank of England. So that's
mm-hmm.
kind of the short thumbnail history of that. Would you agree?
Right. Yes. And of course they had developed trade routes, generations before. I mean, they were always in charge of the trade routes.
Everything centers around trade. Pardon me for interrupting you. We'll
yes.
come back to that. Continue with what you were saying.
And they were also in charge of the slave trade.
Yep.
Long, long before the slave trade that we refer to, associated with America, with the colonial America. I mean, the slave trade was enforced for a long time before.
Well, it goes back thousands of years, and of course that
right.
molding coming out of the Babylonian legal merchant code, all that stuff was just absolutely fine back then.
Sure.
And that is the system they're using on us today in a very backhanded way.
Sure.
And just as you would expect, the most unbelievable intrigue and twisting and pharisaical leaven Okay. I mean,
right.
That's just a great term for it, you know?
Sure.
But as we've said on the, from the start here, there's only two plans, Deanna. God's plan's freedom and Satan's plan is slavery. I don't know of any other plans, and nobody's ever been able to show me one.
Right. And it's amazing to me, too, that, that even within the truth movement, if you can call it that, but even in the so-called truth movement, there are so many, Marxists, people who, maybe we wouldn't call them Marxists, but there are really people who are religion bashers. And, I mean, they're really doing the work of the Marxists without recognizing that that's what they're doing. Or maybe they do recognize it. I don't know.
You know, they've corrupted the institutions. It goes back to the guy's name was Mazzetti. That was the Italian guy that was pioneered a lot of these concepts with Albert Pike, our Confederate general.
Yes.
Okay. And his deal was that instead of a violent type revolution, you go in and you take over the institutions and turn them around and corrupt them. Now that's exactly what they've done in every institution. And I totally understand when people start railing at religion, and what I always try and do is go back in and cut the fine line between religion and spirituality, because those two things are totally different. And yes, all of those religious organizations, from the World Council of Churches on down, have been infiltrated and corrupted, or else you wouldn't have the Scofield Bible dilemma that we've had for 100 or more years.
Or those operations or those groups have been created by the bankers, and then they, for instance, Rockefeller was very much in control in establishing the World Council of Churches and organizations like that. I think it was a World Council. But, when you look behind the curtain, you'll find dirty money. And of course, the Rockefellers have always been monopolizers. And, you have to look at their background. And certainly there is a book on my shelf. It's not within my reach.
Oh, is it the one I'm thinking about? What's the name of it?
Yes.
And it's written by your same guy, Gary Allen, too.
No, that's not the same one.
Okay. I was thinking of the Rockefeller Files.
Yes. I've got that's downstairs. That's in the downstairs bookcase.
Ah. Okay.
But I have another book upstairs here that talks about the Rockefellers and the fact that they are actually Jewish.
I've heard that claim. I never knew where to put it because I never saw any proof on it, but I've certainly had that seen that claim.
Well, you certainly have to wonder. Now, the Carnegies, I don't think they were. Andrew Carnegie's father was a Chartist, which is the same as being a Marxist, before they arrived in this country. Have you ever heard of any Chartism?
I have not, but I know there were some really strange communal communist-type enclaves out there in western Pennsylvania back in the old days from time to time.
Yeah.
I remember reading about them.
Yeah, Chartism. I covered that in my first book. Yeah, Carnegie and Rockefeller made tons of money during the so-called Civil War, because they were both, Rockefeller got a lot of the, he supplied a lot of the, things that they needed, boots and, things that the men needed, and oil, of course. And by 1890, I think he was supplying about 90% of the oil for the entire country.
Yes,
and that was a result of him, his association with the government during the so-called Civil War.
It was
Carnegie made a lot of money, too.
I was going to say that was also because of his collusion with another Rothschild agent, the Harrimans. And they were railroad barons. And what they would do is there weren't any laws against price fixing, and they would haul Standard Oil's oil cheaper than his competitors.
Right.
And he'd go into the competitor and, you know, basically, I'm going to offer you fire insurance. You either merge with Standard Oil and take this stock, or else you're not going to be in the shipping oil. All right. And so that's how he went in and reverse took all of those in to build up those huge, huge monopolies that they had in control.
Sure. Rothschilds, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay. I was just going to say they're just ruthless business.
Sure. Well, the Rothschilds actually financed the Vanderbilts and the Harrimans' railroad interests, as well as Carnegie Steel Industry. It was Rothschild money.
Well, there it says right there in the protocols, we will find a few millionaires and bring them to our cause or something to that effect. They have certainly accomplished that. I should tell the audience that I did get the phones open. If anybody wants to call, it's 866-37-TRUTH. Anything you'd like to ask Deanna, this wonderful wealth of information. Deanna, tell us about, you said your first book in the trilogy. Do you have three books out now?
I actually have four. My four books are, the trilogy is the Ruling Elite Trilogy, and the first one is called A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. The second one is The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And the third one is The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. And then my fourth book is Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences.
Right, I forgot about the Sandy Hook one. Writing a book is not an easy thing.
No, it takes a lot of research and
focus and time. And for me, I can't sit down and be doing three or four different things, and I'm going to write for an hour here today and then pick it up tomorrow or the day after. That's hard for me to do. And I know that from my own experience putting this one together, that it's quite an ordeal. You know, ironically enough, Deanna, I don't know if I told you this, my publisher turned out to be, after the fact, I didn't know it beforehand, after the fact turned out to be Victor Ostrovsky, who had...
Oh, yes, you told me that. What a great publisher. That's super. I have one of his books, or two of them.
I had it when I'm in my book collection in the States before I moved down here. But it's ironic because when he put his books out, he couldn't get any traction anywhere. They weren't giving that book the time of day, and they bad-mouthed it, of course, whenever they did have to bring it up. But
sure.
I think I found it in a brand-new book in a bookstore bargain basement thing for like a dollar and a half or something is where I bought.
Wow.
And I'm sure that had something to do with Victor going and starting this publishing company.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, of course, you know, the Rothschilds too, speaking of media and publishing, is that they owned Reuters, they owned the Associated Press, they owned Havas and Wolf, and currently they have controlling interest in NBC, CBS, ABC, CNN. And the publishing companies, certainly, even the so-called alternative publishing companies. I had my situation trying to get my first book published. I thought I had a publisher. In fact, the publisher approached me, and I said, yes, okay, I'll write a book. But I didn't, you know, it wasn't the book that he thought he was going to get. And when he got it, he said, you got to change this and this and this. And you can't put that these people were Jews. You have to just let the reader figure that out themselves. That's when I decided I would publish it myself.
For fear of the Jews. There's another biblical thing. There's just nothing new under the sun. Remember, he said you're whitewashed sepulchers. Okay. And here you look at these people when we know, after the investigating them for so long and paying closer attention, what kind of people many of them are, not all of them by any means, but they fit that description exactly. The ones that like to get up there in your face like Crystal on Sunday on the TV shows and the other ones, and they just love to get into that. Chuck Schumer, boy, he loves to get on camera in those little national sound bites where they can put him up there in everybody's face, or Lieberman when he used to be there, or whichever one. They just love to get up there. And I remember, and again, I don't remember if you and I talked about it, but this is something that came out of my legal stuff. I just heard it along the way somewhere there in Atlanta. I thought it was very interesting, and it nails down a lot of this stuff, because the Atlanta has the circuit court like Chicago does, which means it's an appellate level court, and it hears lower cases from the district court in the territory that it covers. The 11th Circuit would be Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. And this case came up to Atlanta from a district court in South Florida. And it was a parishioner, a couple, with an argument over a rabbi. And the argument was they had signed a contract and there was some kind of default, and it went all the way to the appellate level. But the important point here, and I don't know the disposition of the case or anything else, the important point is there is a case at the appellate level, circuit level, that deals with the fact that tells us that they still contract for their seats in the synagogue. And you go back and remember Jesus said you always want the finest seats in the synagogue. Now we know that they contract for those, and you mentioned it earlier in something you were talking about, that they only go for the high holy days, and of course those are the ones we just experienced in September, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Right. And so they contract, Babylonian merchant code contract law, with the rabbi for their seats. Deanna, did you know that?
Wow. Now that term you used, whited sepulchers, that's almost as good as leaven, the leaven of the Pharisees.
Yeah, see, all of those things, when you've put it into proper context, man, that it takes those things that I remember reading or hearing when I was young, and it makes them come alive. Hell, I didn't even know what leaven was when I was being thrust into vacation Bible school, you know?
Sure. Well, I've made some leavened bread. I just wanted to see what it was like. And, it's not quite yeast. It's kind of a different thing. Yeast will make bread rise, fuller and faster. But leaven is slower and more subtle. And I think that, that's interesting too.
Well, boy, that is slower and more subtle would probably nail it down, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Deanna, we got a caller. He's one of the guys that's called in a few times. He's from out in the San Francisco area. His name is Shane. Shane, how you doing, man?
Yes, I'm doing very well. Thank you. I want to say thank you to both of you. This time I would like to speed it up. I seem to have spoken very slowly last time, so let me pick up the pace here. Thank you for picking up my call. My question really goes to you, Roger, in regards to, I wrote it down, the statue staple, the Shekhars.
Okay.
The kind of, I was on that particular listening on the podcast, but yet I look for it again and again, and I cannot seem to find it.
All right.
Do you know the exact time and date that was?
No, I don't right off the bat, Shane, but I'll tell you what you can do, and I believe it's on my website, Sovereign to Surf, over there, read a article that was written by a Jewess named Judith Shapiro, and it was published in a very prestigious law journal, the Georgetown Law Review, back in the 1970s, I believe, and it's called How the Jewish Shetar Invaded the English Common Law, something to that effect. or just the common law, and you'll get the whole history of that. And she did a real good job of how that instrument, which is a Babylonian merchant code contract instrument that was specifically used by our friends here and had so much so that it had a specific name to it called a shetar. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, Deanna. And that is in England, when they brought it in and incorporated it, they changed the name to a statute staple. And originally in the towns, the trading towns of England, and they were designated as staple towns. And the mayor of those designated towns was called the mayor of the staple. And it was in trade disputes, and they could, if a merchant, a foreign, you're talking about the trade aspect earlier, Deanna, if the trader did not get paid, see, they couldn't go into the English common law courts. And because the English guy would have somebody come up and lie for him, say, nah, he never took that stuff. That guy's lying, and they'd have to go off getting gypped out of what they did legitimately earn. And so many of the traders quit coming back. Well, England needed things to be brought, and it needed to sell its wares. And so they had to come in and bring the system in to put back legitimacy so the traders could get paid and would start coming back. And that's how this Jewish shetar invaded the English common law. Now, what Judith Shapiro does not, unfortunately, tell us, enlighten us to in the article, is that the Jewish shetar we know as a 1040 form.
My gosh.
Okay? It's a statute staple contract. It's a specific contract under the UCC. And the interesting thing about this, also, let me add another little bit of color here for both of you. Shetar is evidently the origins of the word star, if you've ever heard the term star chambers. Okay. Because they'd have a chest in the back of the room, and they'd open it and pull out these contracts, and then they'd torture you to get the money.
Wow.
Again, the shetar. Okay.
Yes.
So, anyway, that's did that answer your question, Sean?
Please, can you give me a favor and spell that out for me?
S-H-E-T-A-R.
Alright.
Anything else, Shane?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're very welcome, Shane. Thanks for being a good listener, and I know you're reading my book, so we'll take that call another time, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, well,
thank you very much.
Have a great day, Shane. So it's very interesting, Deanna, when you get back and get some of this history, isn't? And
yes.
And now, as I said, we've, you know, banged a couple of times on the show theme today. There's nothing new under the sun.
Exactly. Yes. And your references to the Bible and terms used in the Bible. And I know Clint Richardson is very good. He refers to the Bible a lot. And talks about the etymology of words and what they mean. And sometimes words change. Their meanings change. For instance, gay used to mean that you were really happy, and now it means something totally different. And so when you look at the way things were and what they meant previously, then you can really gain some understanding.
That's why they use symbols. Excuse me.
Yes.
Because symbols don't change, and words not only change, but they're manipulated to change. And this little trick of using your subconscious mind. As we go close to the break here, Deanna, I should ask you, do you know about the longest surviving civilization in the history of the world?
No.
It would be the Byzantine Empire. I saw an article about it a couple of years ago. And the excerpt of the article was written by Ezra Pound. I think most people know who Ezra Pound was.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
And he was the one that did this research. And the Byzantine Empire for 1,200 years would not allow Jews in politics, finance, or teaching.
The reason for its lengthy survival.
Now, very interesting to note that the Byzantine Empire ended right about, you know, I'm sure it's coincidence, Deanna, that it ended just about the time World War I broke out.
I'll be darned. Amazing. And when you look at the history of World War I, how it got started, when it started, the people behind it, and the false flag operations that were used, and the people that were targeted, same people that were targeted in World War II, Germany.
And the ones, the Armenians, least we not forget their competitors.
Exactly.
Because the Armenians are evidently shrewd business people. We're about to get a break here, I think, in a second. I don't want to drop this thread because it's really important information to be drawing these things together. So we'll talk about that when Deanna Spingola and Roger Sales get back here in a second.
Something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
Your DIY Health with Jim Ram. Thursdays on Truth Frequency Radio.
Been warped by the rain, driven by the snow. I'm drunk and dirty, don't you know? And I'm still willing. And I was out on the road late at night. I seen my pretty Alice in every headlight. Alice, Dallas, Alice.
Dallas, Alice, you probably ran into her at one of your quilting shows, Deanna, somewhere along the line.
I think she emailed me. No, I never met her.
Never met Dallas Alice.
No.
Deanna Spingola, Roger Sales, Radio Ranch, last segment, Wednesday show, October the 14th, 2015. Heck of a time to be alive. You know, Deanna, it's interesting because men have wanted to be alive, I think, for this time for thousands of years. And here we find ourselves in that state at this time. And it's really exciting on top of having the understanding to be able to look at it and analyze it and actually identify some sanity in it. Because there is sanity even though it's insane.
Sure. Yes, it's a wonderful time to be alive. There's some terrible things going on, but I've often thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun to be alive at a certain point in history? But then I think, no, I think I'm happy right where I'm at.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm really glad I'm not a young person at this time in history.
Oh, me too. Yeah. I wish I were a little bit younger, but I'm glad I'm not just starting my life. I mean, that would be,
I'll take the wisdom. I'll be a little long in the tooth and take the wisdom. Thank you very much. We were talking right there before the break, and it's an interesting subject to me, about the same time that the, 1,200-year-old Byzantine Empire tanked. We had World War I. We had another closet Edomite named Ataturk that was enthroned that went over and disarmed a neighboring ethnic group called the Armenians, which are very, very bright people. Okay.
Yes. I wrote about them.
Oh, you did? Well, tell us what you wrote, if you can recall some of it.
That's the problem with, I write stuff.
Well, that's that age stuff.
I figure I don't need to remember it if I can look it up. But what is very interesting is that, Morgenthau, actually in 1918, was the ambassador to the Ottoman Empire.
Oh.
Now Morgenthau is, well, the same guy that, that proposed the Morgenthau plan for Germany.
Oh, Deanna, did you just put a big piece of the puzzle in there?
And I wrote about it in my second book, too. But yeah, there, if you look farther, you know, far enough, deep enough, you're going to find that, that there's a Jewish person that has some sort of influence or connection to just about any genocide.
Look at the guy that was in the Southern, in the Confederacy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Sure. And he was certainly sent there, to do exactly, and he actually, escaped with all the gold, the Southern gold, to England.
Judith P. Benjamin for the audience.
Yes. Yes. He got all of that gold and escaped to England and lived happily ever after.
In fact, he died as the chief counselor to the queen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And people don't, getting back to Morgenthau, people don't understand the function of U.S. ambassadors to these various countries. But, yeah. That book, during the break, we were talking about Rockefeller.
Yes.
It's called The Grandees, The Story of America's Sephardic Elite. It's by Stephen Birmingham.
You've got incredible sources, and I know that you've gone through a lot of dedication to get the understanding that you've been able to arrive at, Deanna. But as I was saying earlier and mentioned, I read back when I was really investigating this 18 years ago,
mm-hmm.
more than I do now. I mean, you just get to a point where you know the leopard's got spots and you sit back and watch him, you know.
Sure.
But as you're reading in their own, people from their own ethnic group sit there and write these books that are easily available on the web. There was one I remember, Jews Must Live. I don't remember who the author was of that, but that was about how they go in and take over businesses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And all these things, and it's such common knowledge. And but boy, there's some kind of a big reckoning coming.
Oh, absolutely.
Now they have fortunately given us the platform and set the precedent with the Nuremberg trials.
Oh, yes. I wrote about that, too.
And I hear these people talk about jail time and stuff. Listen, this isn't jail time offenses that we've witnessed here. Doesn't seem like to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I like the way they deal with crooked bankers in Iran.
Oh, yes. And or medical doctors in China. If you're in China and you have a problem and you take your relative has a sickness and the relative dies, then they have a group over there that goes and kills the doctor.
We're not advocating that at the Radio Range. I don't want to stir that pile of manure, okay?
No. But you were talking about the Armenian Genocide, and that was really, the Jews took power during the Young Turk Revolution, and they killed probably 1.5 million Armenians.
It was huge for the population per capita.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, the same old blueprint, they went in and disarmed them first, and then they went back and massacred them.
Yes. Yep. Yep. That's what they did. And as I say, Henry Morgenthau Sr., and he's a he was a member of the Pilgrim Society. He was a member of B'nai B'rith. He was a Harlem real estate mogul, and he was a leader in New York City's Reform Jewish community. And his money put Woodrow Wilson into the White House, and then he became the ambassador to Turkey.
It seems to be that the main center of this comes out of this reform sect. What have your studies told you about these different sects, the Hasidim or the Hasidics, the reform, and some of these factions?
You know, I really have not studied the different factions, but you're right. The reform sect, and I hate to say this, but the Episcopalian, they are very, most of the bankers who are, call themselves Christian, are usually members of the Episcopal Church, and they do all kinds of, well, they do a lot of,
didn't they allow homosexuals?
They make a lot of money. They make a lot of money. Yes, they did. They make a lot of money. They have a lot of big, big, big investments. Anyway,
they were the first ones to allow women to be priests too, if I don't recall correctly. Is that correct?
I'm not sure.
Seems like that may be very liberal oriented sect.
Yeah.
I think most of them need to be Presbyterians.
Yeah.
You know what those are?
No.
That's where, when you die, your soul goes up on top of the house.
Oh, I see.
And maybe that's a good place. No, that's too high for theirs. Theirs needs to go a little lower, maybe in the basement or lower.
Sure.
So they can worship their Lloyd Blank Field God.
Yeah.
Blank Fine God. So,
go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Deanna.
But Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, who was the leading member and founder of the Zionist Organization of America, actually convinced Henry Morgenthau Sr. to accept that position as ambassador, and he was the ambassador from 1913 to 1916. And the fact that he wrote a book about it afterward is just, oh, look, this is what happened. Oh, my goodness, what a shame. As if he didn't have anything to do with it at all, when in fact he was there and was instrumental in it.
They're real good about whitewashing themselves right out of the picture.
Oh, they are. They sure are.
They instigate and whitewash.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Which goes along with the whited sepulcher.
That's very interesting that you mentioned Rabbi Wise. He was a real big kingpin 80 years or so ago. I think the leading rabbi in America. One of the quotes that I've seen attributed to him was the Jews.
Oh, yeah. I know which one you're going to say.
Are their own gods.
Yeah. And the other one, let's see, what other one did he say? He said, well, that Judaism was communism.
Yes.
Communism is Judaism.
I'm going to tell you, I wonder if you've ever seen this book. Have you ever seen Pastor Ted Weiland's book called God's Covenant People, Yesterday, Today, and Forever?
No, but I've interviewed him. I don't think I have that book.
I should get Ted on the air. That is a fabulous work.
He is very good. I have read some of his things, and like I say, I have interviewed him. And
I'm crossed paths with him years ago in Atlanta at some festival conflabs.
Mm-hmm.
And neat guy. He was a professional rodeo guy. For the audience, this is one of those go-to sites. You know, there's several out there. Mention them probably nowhere near often enough. Pastor Ted Weiland's site is missiontoisrael.org. His book that I'm going to elaborate on just a second here, and for you too, Deanna, because you need this up on your bookshelf, girl. And I'm going to tell you why, all right, is his first work that he put out. And what he does is goes back in, and my suggestion to people is to take the first five chapters of the book, and if you're not really strongly scripturally based, put those off to the side and start reading at chapter 6. And then when you finish the book, then go back and read 1 through 5. I think the order would have probably lost some people along the way. Those 6 through 12 chapters, what he does is take all of these different topics, Deanna, and he puts the Christian side and the references on one side, and then he puts the opposing issue with all they say on it on the other side. Now, the reason that I said it's important probably for you to have, especially in your work, is because of the way he's got the index set up. In the back, by the way, there's 55 pages of references.
Wow.
And behind that is a cross index. And he takes every important word, anti-Semite, whatever it might be, and goes back and shows you everywhere under what topic that was used. And I've seen quotes in there that I've never seen anywhere else. It was a super powerful book to me. And it just absolutely, on this issue that we're talking about today, it shut the door on it when I read that.
Wow. Now, Mission to Israel, he's not talking about the Israeli state.
He's talking about the 12 tribes.
The 12 tribes, the real 12 tribes, and not the Jews who call themselves Jews, but who aren't.
I think most of the people in this audience understand that that's another one of the Sun Tzu tricks. If you want to look at it like that, if you don't know yourself and you don't know your enemy, you've got no chance of winning any battle. And that's exactly the position they've put us in.
Sure. Sure.
Well, that's Deanna, so before we get too much further and get crunched at the end, for the people that are not familiar with how to get a hold of you and your absolute wealth of work and your ongoing efforts, why don't you give us a rundown, please?
All righty. People may visit my website, spingola.com, and find information about my books. And there's a lot of articles that I wrote. I haven't been writing articles recently because I've been working on books. People may also visit spingolaspeaks.net. For all the audio files of my programs. And people may also visit screeningsandyhook.net for information about that book. And for, well, every once in a while I put up an article. And anyway, those are the resources that people will want to look at. And on my website, spingola.com, I have a timeline of book 2 and 3. And I think that when you look at timelines, I think it gives you kind of a map, so to speak, of what happened. For instance, in 1897. A lot of things happened in 1897. And that was the year of the first Zionist conference. That was the year before the United States invaded the Philippines. I mean, there's just a lot of things that happened in 1897. And so I think the timeline is, of course, it's not complete. It's kind of a work in progress. But it just kind of gives you an idea of when things happened, why, and then you can kind of put things together.
I think that was one of the biggest steps I've taken in my project in years because, you know, what we talk about is, especially used to in the approach that we used, was complicated, and you had to have people's attention, pretty close attention, for a long period of time before you get to the punchline. So for all these years, I've striven, been striving, have strove, however you conjugate that word. I've been striving to try and simplify it and to get it simplified where it's understandable easily and as quick a uptake as possible so people don't have to fumble through all the minutia, because they can work on that as they go forward instead of trying to get them through the minutia to get to the big picture. You kind of reverse it. And that switch into a timeline presentation was, I think, the most effective thing that I've done in this the whole time I've been involved with it.
Right. Timelines, I think, are very essential. Yeah, I do.
Because I can sit there and lay the whole thing out, only mention one or two court cases, never talk about regulations or laws or this section or that section or some other foolishness that gets people distracted. And you
sure.
can hold them on the nugget of the concept and the idea that you're trying to get across to them. So it's a powerful way of doing it. I really like it. In fact, I want to make a video. I'd like to do another video and do a timeline video. But we'll see. Get around to it.
Sure.
So, anything else? We got, I guess, about 6 minutes, 7 minutes or so, Deanna. What else would you like to add, or would you like to explore something?
I was just looking at, thinking again about the Armenian situation, and all wars. When you look at what these people do to other people, and getting back to Columbus, Christopher Columbus, and all of his followers, because he was certainly a somebody that they followed. I mean, if he did it, then they did it. And I mean, he was burning people at the stake. He was roasting them above, putting a dozen at a time above fires, and they roasted them. And the Armenians, the individual who was kind of in charge, Belkond. He was a British agent, and he told about the situation in early 1915 when a bunch of soldiers ordered some Armenians to gather sufficient thorns and thistles to create a tall pyramid. Thereafter, the soldiers tied almost 5,000 Armenians together around the pyramid and then torched it. And there was screaming, these are things you can barely talk about, but the torture and the pain that they inflict physically, not just emotionally and economically, but physically is so awful. And I don't know. It just is enough to just.
Deanna, I had one of our regular listeners, I hadn't heard from him for a while, just IM'd me, and he asked if you would spell your website slowly.
Okay. S as in Sam, P as in Paul, I, N as in Nancy, G-O-L-A. Spingola.
I think that's pretty good. There's a wealth of, Doc, there's a wealth of information over there. Deanna has a regular radio show on another network, as they say. I think she might have left that out a minute ago. And
yes,
so I wanted to be sure and let folks know how they can access your work on the airwaves here.
Okay. Yes. I am with RBN, and just as of yesterday, I will be on RBN on Thursday and Friday night between 6 and 8 o'clock. And then I'm also on Saturday, and that's Central Time. And then on Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m., and that's Central Time, of course. And then I also have a blog talk radio program on Monday and Thursday, and information is on my website about those programs. In fact, I have to update to include the Thursday and Friday because, like I say, it's just a brand new, John Stadtmiller asked me if I would like to take some more time, and I said yes. I used to be on Monday through Friday, but then things happened.
Yeah, well, changes happen. Certainly, the radio industry is in flux, and this internet radio specifically. I'm really glad to see John giving you more time back, and because everybody may not be interested, but these are topics that need to be discussed.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
This, you know, you can't talk about anything. You can't, you know, that ain't going to fly. That dog don't hunt. Okay.
Right.
These things are going to get discussed and they are going to get exposed and we are going to find out what the hell's been going on and who's been doing it and how. And there are going to be some changes made, just like Chet Atkins says in that bumper music song I got. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, those days are coming. They're obviously can't come fast enough. Who knows the situation that we're going to be in when they do come and do arrive. But I promise you, just like the sun is setting today and rising tomorrow, those days are coming.
Right. And I think more and more people are waking up. I mean, I'd like to believe that more and more people are waking up. When I first started radio, I'm sure that I talked about a lot of things that people were just kind of appalled that I was talking about these things. And now they're not shocked. Now they seem to be looking around and saying, yeah, you know, she might be right. Or, you know, Roger might be right. Yes, we are right.
Well, I'll tell you what, I've been called every name under the sun to get to this point. And, it's very good feeling to be vindicated.
Sure. Sure.
But it's amazing to me how many people that used to call you names and talk bad about you will never come back and say, hey, you know what? You were right.
Yep.
Occasionally you'll get one, but not often.
Right. And if you're over the target, you're going to get criticism from the people we're criticizing. And that has happened.
Well, definitely. You know, that's Voltaire's famous statement.
Yes.
To know who rules over you, look at who you can't criticize.
Exactly.
He knew what was going on, and I can tell by just a couple of the quotes that this is the other one that spoke legions to me. Voltaire quote, he said, before we discuss, let us define our terms.
Yes, yes. Absolutely.
He knew the word trick, see?
Oh, and my favorite, truth does not fear investigation. A friend of mine just just Skyped me, and I was just about to say that. So, great minds.
Well, we'll invest.
And truly,
that's very true.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad that I've got the great mind of Deanna Spingola at my disposal and all the things you've been able to accumulate and acquire, Deanna, and thank you for being with us. We're right pretty close to the close. We'll have you back because I enjoy these discussions, and I think that the audience does too. And what's happening is we don't have anything set up to discuss necessarily. We just get on here and start talking, and you'll say something, and it stimulates something I've got buried back I'd forgotten, and I bring it out, and it reverse does that to you. So
yes.
A lot of times you can get some real interesting things that neither one of us knew.
Exactly, yes.
So we'll have you back, girl. I'm glad you're getting more hours. If anybody needs to hear, get more of her Spingola fix, you can go check it out and take advantage of one of those numerous days that she's on the air. Thank you, Deanna, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Thank you, Roger.
Okay, I'll see you.
All righty.
And there's our whistler, and I guess I'll say I'll see you to the audience, too. From Argentina, buenas tardes, hasta luego, and ciao.